the air day. I could go another couple of days before I ran out of oxygen, and getting away from the storm is pretty important, but I decided against it. I'm far enough ahead of the storm that I can afford one day of no movement, and I don't know if a couple more days would help. Who knows how far south the storm goes? Well, NASA probably knows, and the news stations back on Earth are probably showing it, and there's probably a website like www.watch-mark-watney-die.com. So there's like 100 million people or so who know exactly how far south it goes. But I'm not one of them. Log entry. Sol 484. Finally. I am finally past the goddamn storm. Today's power regen was 100%. No more dust in the air. With the storm moving perpendicular to my direction of travel, it means I'm south of the southernmost point of the cloud, presuming it's a circular storm. If it's not, then fuck. Starting tomorrow, I can go directly towards Schiaparelli, which is good, because I lost a lot of time. I went 540 kilometers due south while avoiding that storm. I'm catastrophically off course. Mind you, it hasn't been that bad. I'm well into Terra Meridiani now, and the driving is a little easier here than the rugged, ass-kicking terrain of Arabia Terra. Schiaparelli is almost due east, and if my sextant and Phobos calculations are correct, I've got another 1,030 kilometers to get there. Accounting for air days and presuming 90 kilometers of travel per sol, I should arrive on Sol 498. Not too bad, really. The nearly Mark Killen storm only ended up delaying me by 4 sols. I'll still have 44 sols to do whatever MAV modifications NASA has in mind. Log entry. Sol 487. I have an interesting opportunity here. And by opportunity, I mean opportunity. I got pushed so far off course, I'm actually not far from the Mars exploration rover Opportunity. It's about 300 kilometers away. I could get there in about 4 sols. Damn, it's tempting. If I could get Opportunity's radio working, I'd be in touch with humanity again. NASA would continually tell me my exact position and best course, warn me if another storm was on its way, and generally be there watching over me. But if I'm being honest, that's not the real reason I'm interested. I'm sick of being on my own, damn it. Once I got Pathfinder working, I got used to talking to Earth. All that went away because I leaned a drill against the wrong table, and now I'm alone again. I could end that in just 4 sols. But it's an irrational, stupid thought. I'm only 11 sols away from the MAV. Why go out of my way to dig up another broken-ass rover to use as a makeshift radio when I'll have a brand-new, fully functional communication system within a couple of weeks? So while it's really tempting that I'm within striking range of another rover, man, we really littered this planet with them, didn't we? It's not the smart move. Besides, I've defiled enough future historical sites for now. Log entry. Sol 492. I need to put some thought into the bedroom. Right now, I can only have it set up when I'm inside the rover. It attaches to the airlock, so I can't get out if it's there. During my road trip, that doesn't matter because I have to furl it every day anyway. But once I get to the MAV, I won't have to drive around anymore. Each decompress and recompress of the bedroom stresses the seams. I learned that lesson the hard way when the hab blew up. So it's best if I can find a way to leave it out. Holy shit, I just realized I actually believe I'll get to the MAV. See what I did there? I casually talked about what I'll do after I get to the MAV. Like it was nothing, no big deal. I'm just going to pop over to Schiaparelli and hang with the MAV there. Nice. Anyway, I don't have another airlock. I've got one on the rover and one on the trailer, and that's it. They're firmly fixed in place, so it's not like I can detach one and attach it to the bedroom. But I can seal the bedroom entirely. I don't even have to do any hatchet jobs on it. The airlock attachment point has a flap I can unroll and seal the opening with. Remember, I stole the airlock attachment from a pop tent, which is an emergency feature for pressure loss while in the rover. It'd be pretty useless if it couldn't seal itself off. Unfortunately, as an emergency device, it was never intended to be reusable. The idea was that people seal themselves in the pop tent, Then the rest of the crew drives to wherever they are in the other rover and rescues them. The crew of the good rover detaches the pop tent from the breached rover and reattaches it to theirs. Then they cut through the seal from their side to recover their crewmates. To make sure this would always be an option, mission rules dictated no more than 3 people could be in a rover at once, and both rovers had to be fully functional or we couldn't use either. So here's my brilliant plan. I won't use the bedroom as a bedroom anymore once I get to the MAV. I'll use it to house the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator. Then I'll use the trailer as my bedroom. Neat, eh? The trailer has tons of space. I put a shitload of work into making that happen. The balloon gives plenty of headroom. Not a lot of floor space, but still lots of vertical area. Also, the bedroom has several valve apertures in its canvas. I have the Habs design to thank for that. The canvas I stole from it has valve apertures, triple redundant ones, actually. NASA wanted to make sure the hab could be refilled from the outside if necessary. In the end, I'll have the bedroom sealed with the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator inside. It'll be attached to the trailer via hoses to share the same atmosphere, and I'll run a power line through one of the hoses. The rover will serve as storage, because I won't need to get to the driving controls anymore, and the trailer will be completely empty. Then I'll have a permanent bedroom. I'll even be able to use it as a workshop for whatever MAV modifications I need to do on parts that can fit through the trailer's airlock. Of course, if the atmospheric regulator or oxygenator have problems, I'll need to cut into the bedroom to get to them. But I've been here 492 sols and they've worked fine the whole time, so I'll take that risk. Log entry. Sol 497. I'll be at the entrance to Schiaparelli tomorrow. Presuming nothing goes wrong, that is, but hey, everything else has gone smoothly this mission, right? That was sarcasm. Today's an air day, and for once, I don't want it. I'm so close to Schiaparelli I can taste it. I guess it would taste like sand, mostly, but that's not the point. Of course, that won't be the end of the trip. It'll take another 3 sols to get from the entrance to the MAV, but hot damn, I'm almost there. I think I can even see the rim of Schiaparelli. It's way the hell off in the distance, and it might just be my imagination. It's 62 kilometers away, so if I'm seeing it, I'm only just barely seeing it. Tomorrow, once I get to Entrance Crater, I'll turn south and enter the Schiaparelli Basin via the entrance ramp. I did some back-of-the-napkin math, and the slope should be pretty safe. The elevation change from the rim to the basin is 1.5 kilometers. And the ramp is at least 45 kilometers long. That makes for a 2-degree grade. No problem. Tomorrow night, I'll sink to an all-new low. Let me rephrase that. Tomorrow night, I'll be at rock bottom. No, that doesn't sound good either. Tomorrow night, I'll be in Giovanni Schiaparelli's favorite hole. Okay, I admit, I'm just playing around now. For millions of years, the rim of the crater had been under constant attack from wind. It eroded the rocky crest the way a river cuts through a mountain range. After eons, it finally breached the edge. The high-pressure zone created by the wind now had an avenue to drain. The breach widened more and more with each passing millennium. As it widened, dust and sand particles carried along with the attack settled in the basin below. Eventually, a balance point was reached. The sand had piled up high enough to be flush with the land outside the crater. It no longer built upward, but outward. The slope lengthened until a new balance point was reached, one defined by the complex interactions of countless tiny particles and their ability to maintain an angled shape. Entrance ramp had been born. The weather brought dunes and desert terrain. Nearby crater impacts brought rocks and boulders. The shape became uneven. Gravity did its work. The ramp compressed over time, but it did not compress evenly. Differing densities shrunk at different rates. Some areas became hard as rock, while others remained as soft as talc. While providing a small average slope into the crater, the ramp itself was rugged and bitterly uneven. On reaching Entrance Crater, the lone inhabitant of Mars turned his vehicle toward the Schiaparelli Basin. The difficult terrain of the ramp was unexpected, but it looked no worse than other terrain he routinely navigated. He went around the smaller dunes and carefully crested the larger ones. He took care with every turn, every rise or fall in elevation, and every boulder in his path. He thought through every course and considered all alternatives. But it wasn't enough. The rover, while descending down a seemingly ordinary slope, drove off an invisible ridge. The dense, hard soil suddenly gave way to soft powder. With the entire surface covered by at least 5 centimeters of dust, there were no visual hints to the sudden change. The rover's left front wheel sank. The sudden tilt brought the right rear wheel completely off the ground. This, in turn, put more weight on the left rear wheel, which slipped from its precarious purchase into the powder as well. Before the traveler could react, the rover rolled onto its side. As it did, the solar cells neatly stacked on the roof flew off and scattered like a dropped deck of cards. The trailer, attached to the rover with a tow clamp, was dragged along. The torsion on the clamp snapped the strong composite like a brittle twig. The hoses connecting the two vehicles also snapped. The trailer plunged headlong into the soft soil and flipped over onto its balloon roof, shuddering to an abrupt halt. The rover was not so lucky. It continued tumbling down the hill, bouncing the traveler around like clothes in a dryer. After 20 meters, the soft powder gave way to more solid sand, and the rover shuddered to a halt. It had come to rest on its side. The valves leading to the now missing hoses had detected the sudden pressure drop and closed. The pressure seal was not breached. The traveler was alive for now. Chapter 24. The department heads stared at the satellite image on the projection screen.
"Jesus," Mitch said. "What the hell happened?"
"The rover's on its side," Mindy said, pointing to the screen. "The trailer's upside down. Those rectangles scattered around are solar cells."
Venkat put a hand on his chin.
"Do we have any information on the state of the rover pressure vessel?"
"Nothing obvious," Mindy said.
"Any signs of Watney doing something after the accident? An EVA, maybe?"
"No EVA," Mindy said. "The weather's clear. If he'd come out, there'd be visible footsteps." "Is this the entire crash site?" Brucing asked. "I think so," Mindy said. "Up toward the top of the photo, which is north, there are ordinary wheel tracks. Right here," she pointed to a large disturbance in the soil, "is where I think things went wrong. Judging by where that ditch is, I'd say the rover rolled and slid from there. You can see the trench it left behind. The trailer flipped forward onto its roof."
"I'm not saying everything's okay," Bruce said. "But I don't think it's as bad as it looks."
"Go on," Venkat said.
"The rover's designed to handle a roll," Bruce explained. "And if there'd been pressure loss, there'd be a starburst pattern in the sand. I don't see anything like that."
"Watney may still be hurt inside," Mitch said. "He could have banged his head or broken an arm or something."
"Sure," Bruce said. "I'm just saying the rover is probably okay."
"When was this taken?"
Mindy checked her watch. "We got it 17 minutes ago. We'll get another pick in 9 minutes when MGS-4's orbit brings it into view."
"First thing he'll do is an EVA to assess damage," Venkat said. "Mindy, keep us posted on any changes."
Log entry. Sol 498.
Yeah. Things didn't go well on the descent into Schiaparelli Basin. To give you some indication of how unwell they went, I'm reaching up to the computer to type this, because it's still mounted near the control panel and the rover is on its side. I got bounced around a lot, but I'm a well-honed machine in times of crisis. As soon as the rover toppled, I curled into a ball and cowered. That's the kind of action hero I am. It worked, too, because I'm not hurt. The pressure vessel is intact, so that's a plus. The valves that led to the trailer hoses are shut. Probably means the hoses disconnected. And that means the trailer junction snapped. Wonderful. Looking around the interior here, I don't think anything is broken. The water tanks stayed sealed. There aren't any visible leaks in the air tanks. The bedroom came unfolded, and it's all over the place, but it's just canvas, so it can't have gotten too hurt. The driving controls are okay, and the nav computer is telling me the rover is at an unacceptably dangerous tilt.
Thanks, Nav. So, I rolled. That's not the end of the world. I'm alive, and the rover's fine. I'm more worried about the solar cells I probably rolled over. Also, since the trailer detached, there's a good chance it's fucked up, too. The balloon roof it has isn't exactly durable. If it popped, the shit inside will have been flung out in all directions, and I'll have to go find it. That's my critical life support. Speaking of life support, the rover switched over to the local tanks when the valve shut. Good boy, Rover. Here's a Scooby snack. I've got 20 liters of oxygen, enough to keep me breathing for 40 days. But without the regulator, which is in the trailer, I'm back to chemical CO2 absorption. I have 312 hours of filters left. Plus, I have another 171 hours of EVA suit CO2 filters as well. All told, that gives me 483 hours, which is close to 20 sols. So I have time to get things working again. I'm really damn close to the MAV now, about 220 kilometers. I'm not going to let something like this stop me from getting there, and I don't need everything to work at top form anymore. I just need the rover to work for 220 more kilometers and the life support to work for 51 more sols. That's it. Time to suit up and look for the trailer. Log entry. Sol 498. 2. I had an EVA, and things aren't too bad. Mind you, they're not good. I trashed 3 solar cells. They're under the rover and cracked all to hell. They might still be able to piss out a few watts, but I'm not holding out much hope. Luckily, I did come into this with 1 extra solar cell. I needed 28 for my daily operations, and I brought 29, 14 on the rover's roof, 7 on the trailer's roof, and 8 on the makeshift shelves I installed on the sides of both vehicles. I tried pushing the rover over, but I wasn't strong enough. I'll need to rig something to get a leverage advantage. Other than being on its side, I don't see any real problems. Well, that's not true. The tow hook is ruined beyond repair, half of it ripped clean off. Fortunately, the trailer also has a tow hook, so I have a spare. The trailer's in a precarious situation. It's upside down and sitting on the inflated roof. I'm not sure which god smiled down on me and kept that balloon from popping, but I'm grateful. My first priority will be righting it. The longer it puts weight on that balloon, the larger the chances it'll pop. While I was out, I collected the 26 solar cells that aren't under the rover and set them up to recharge my batteries. May as well, right? So right now, I have a few problems to tackle. First, I need to right the trailer, or at least get the weight off the balloon. Next, I need to right the rover. Finally, I need to replace the rover's tow hook with the one on the trailer. Also, I should spell out a message for NASA. They're probably worried. Mindy read the Morse code aloud. Rolled. Fixing now.
What? That's it? Venkat said over the phone.
That's all he said, she reported, cradling the phone as she typed out an email to the list of interested parties.
Just 3 words? Nothing about his physical health, his equipment, his supplies?
You got me, she said. He left a detailed status report. I just decided to lie for no reason.
Funny, Venkat said. Be a smartass to a guy 7 levels above you at your company. See how that works out.
Oh, no, Mindy said. I might lose my job as an interplanetary voyeur. I guess I'd have to use my master's degree for something else.
I remember when you were shy.
I'm space paparazzi now. The attitude comes with the job.
Yeah, Finkett said. Just send the email.
Already sent.
Log entry. Sol 499.
I had a busy day today, and I got a lot done. I started out pretty sore. I had to sleep on the wall of the rover. The bedroom won't work when the airlock is facing up. I did get to use the bedroom somewhat. I folded it up and used it as a bed. Anyway, suffice it to say the wall of the rover wasn't made for sleeping on. But after a morning potato and Vicodin, I was feeling much better. At first I figured my top priority was the trailer. Then I changed my mind. After taking a good look at it, I decided I'd never be able to ride it by myself. I'd need the rover. So today was focused on getting the rover righted. I brought all my tools along on this trip, figuring I'd need them for the MAV modifications, and along with them, I brought cabling. Once I get set up at the MAV, my solar cells and batteries will be in a fixed position. I don't want to move the rover around every time I use a drill on the far side of the MAV, so I brought all the electrical cabling I could fit. Good thing, too, because it doubles as rope. I dug up my longest cable. It's the same one I used to power the drill that destroyed Pathfinder. I call it my lucky cable. I plugged one end into the battery and the other into the infamous sample drill, then walked off with the drill to find solid ground. Once I found it, I kept going until I'd gone as far as the electrical line would reach. I drove a 1 meter bit half a meter into a rock, unplugged the power line, and tied it around the base of the bit. Then I went back to the rover and tied off the cord to the roof rack bar on the high side. Now I had a long, taut line running perpendicular to the rover. I walked to the middle of the cord and pulled it laterally. The leverage advantage on the rover was huge. I only hoped it wouldn't break the drill bit before it tipped the rover. I backed away, pulling the line more and more. Something had to give, and it wasn't going to be me. I had Archimedes on my side. The rover finally tipped. It fell onto its wheels, kicking up a large cloud of soft dust. It was a silent affair. I was far enough away that the thin atmosphere had no hope of carrying the sound to me. I untied the power line, liberated the drill bit, and returned to the rover. I gave it a full systems check. That's a boring-as-hell task, but I had to do it. Every system and subsystem was working correctly. JPL did a damn good job making these rovers. If I get back to Earth, I'm buying Bruce Ng a beer. I guess I should buy all the JPL guys a beer. Beer's for everyone if I get back to Earth. Anyway, with the rover back on its wheels, it was time to work on the trailer. Problem is, I ran out of daylight. Remember, I'm in a crater. I'd gotten most of the way down the ramp when I rolled the rover, and the ramp is up against the western edge of the crater, so the sun sets really early from my point of view. I'm in the shadow of the western wall, and that royally sucks. Mars is not Earth. It doesn't have a thick atmosphere to bend light and carry particles that reflect light around corners. It's damn near a vacuum here. Once the sun is invisible, I'm in the dark. Phobos gives me some moonlight, but not enough to work with. Deimos is a little piece of crap that's no good to anyone. I hate to leave the trailer sitting on its balloon for another night, but there's not much else I can do. I figure it survived a whole day like that. It's probably stable for now. And hey, with the rover righted, I get to use the bedroom again. It's the simple things in life that matter. Log entry. Sol 500. When I woke up this morning, the trailer hadn't popped yet, so that was a good start. The trailer was a bigger challenge than the rover. I only had to tip the rover. I'd need to completely flip the trailer. That requires a lot more force than yesterday's little leverage trick. The first step was to drive the rover to near the trailer. Then came the digging. Oh, God, the digging. The trailer was upside down with its nose pointed downhill. I decided the best way to ride it was to take advantage of the slope and roll the trailer over its nose, basically to make it do a somersault to land on its wheels. I can make this happen by tying off the cable to the rear of the trailer and towing with the rover, but if I tried that without digging a hole first, the trailer would just slide along the ground. I needed it to tip up. I needed a hole for the nose to fall into. So, I dug a hole. A hole 1 meter across, 3 meters wide, and 1 meter deep. It took me 4 miserable hours of hard labor, but I got it done. I hopped in the rover and drove it downhill, dragging the trailer with me. As I'd hoped, the trailer nosed into the hole and tipped up. From there, it fell onto its wheels with a huge plume of dust. Then I sat for a moment, dumbstruck that my plan had actually worked. And now I'm out of daylight again. I can't wait to get out of this damn shadow. All I need is one day of driving toward the MAV and I'll be away from the wall. But for now, it's another early night. I'll spend tonight without the trailer to manage my life support. It may be righted, but I have no idea if the shit inside still works. The rover still has ample supplies for me. I'll spend the rest of the evening enjoying a potato. And by enjoying, I mean hating so much I want to kill people. Log entry. Sol 501. I started the day with some nothing tea.
Nothing tea is easy to make. First, get some hot water, then add nothing. I experimented with potato skin tea a few weeks ago. The less said about that, the better. I ventured into the trailer today. Not an easy task. It's pretty cramped in there. I had to leave my EVA suit in the airlock. The first thing I noticed was that it was really hot inside. It took me a few minutes to work out why. The atmospheric regulator was still in perfect working order, but it had nothing to do. Without being connected to the rover, it no longer had my CO2 production to deal with. The atmosphere in the trailer was perfect. Why change anything? With no regulation necessary, the air was not being pumped out to the AREC for freeze separation, and thus it wasn't coming back in as a liquid in need of heating. But remember, the RTG gives off heat all the time. You can't stop it, so the heat just built up. Eventually, things reached a balance point where the heat bled through the hull as fast as the RTG could add it. If you're curious, that balance point was a sweltering 41 degrees Celsius. I did a full diagnostic on the regulator and the oxygenator, and I'm happy to report both are working perfectly. The RTG's water tank was empty, which is no surprise. It has an open top, not intended to be turned upside down. The floor of the trailer has a lot of puddled water that took me quite a while to sop up with my jumpsuit. I topped the tank off with some more water from a sealed container that I'd stored in the trailer earlier. Remember, I need that water to have something for the returning air to bubble through. That's my heating system. But all things considered, it was good news. The critical components are working fine, and both vehicles are back on their wheels. The hoses that connected the rover and trailer were designed well and released without breaking. I simply snapped them back into place, and the vehicles were sharing life support again. The one remaining thing to fix was the tow hook. It was absolutely ruined. It took the full force of the crash. But as I suspected, the trailer's tow hook was unscathed, so I transferred it to the rover and reconnected the two vehicles for travel. All told, that little fender bender cost me 4 souls. But now I'm back in action. Sort of. What if I run into another powder pit? I got lucky this time. Next time I might not get off so easy. I need a way to know if the ground in front of me is safe, at least for the duration of my time on the ramp. Once I'm in the Schiaparelli Basin proper, I can count on the normal sandy terrain I'm used to. If I could have anything, it would be a radio to ask NASA the safe path down the ramp. Well, if I could have anything, it would be for the green-skinned yet beautiful Queen of Mars to rescue me so she can learn more about this Earth thing called love-making. It's been a long time since I've seen a woman. Just saying. Anyway, to ensure I don't crash again, seriously, no women in, like, years. I don't ask for much. Believe me, even back on Earth, a botanist slash mechanical engineer doesn't exactly have ladies lined up at the door, but still, come on. Anyway, I'll drive slower, like a crawl. That should give me enough time to react if one wheel starts to sink. Also, the lower speed will give me more torque, making it less likely I'll lose traction. Up till now, I've been driving 25 kilometers per hour, so I'm going to cut that to 5 kilometers per hour. I'm still toward the top of the ramp, but the whole thing is only 45 kilometers. I can take my time and get safely to the bottom in about 8 hours. I'll do it tomorrow. I'm already out of daylight again today. That's another bonus. Once I clear the ramp, I can start beelining toward the MAV, which will take me away from the crater wall. I'll be back to enjoying the entire day's sunlight instead of just half of it. If I get back to Earth, I'll be famous, right? A fearless astronaut who beat all the odds, right? I bet women like that. More motivation to stay alive.
So it looks like he's fixed everything, Mindy explained. And his message today was all better now, so I guess he's got everything working.
She surveyed the smiling faces in the meeting room.
Awesome, Mitch said.
Great news,
Bruce's voice came in through the speakerphone. Venkat leaned forward to the phone.
How are the MAV modification plans coming, Bruce? Is JPL going to have that procedure soon?
We're working around the clock on it, Bruce said. We're past most of the big hurdles. Working out the details now.
Good, good, Venkat said. Any surprises I should know about?
Bruce said. Yeah, a few. This might not be the best venue for it.
I'll be back in Houston with the procedure in a day or two. We can go through it then.
Ominous, Venkat said. But okay, we'll pick it up later.
Can I spread the word? Annie asked. It'd be nice to see something other than the rover crash site on the news tonight.
Definitely, Venkat said. It'll be nice to have some good news for a change. Mindy, how long until he gets to the MAV?
At his usual rate of 90 kilometers per sol, Mindy said. He should get there on Sol 504, Sol 505 if he takes his time. He always drives in the early morning, finishing around noon.
She checked an application on her laptop.
Noon on Sol 504 will be 11:41 a.m. this Wednesday here in Houston. Noon on Sol 505 will be 12:21 p.m. on Thursday.
Mitch, who's handling Ares 4 MAV communications?
The Ares 3 mission control team, Mitch replied. It'll be in control room 2.
I assume you'll be there?
Bet your ass I'll be there.
So will I.
Log entry. Sol 502. Every Thanksgiving, my family used to drive from Chicago to Sandusky, an 8-hour drive. It's where Mom's sister lived. Dad always drove, and he was the slowest, most cautious driver who ever took the wheel. Seriously, he drove like he was taking a driver's test. Never exceeded the speed limit, always had his hands at 10 and 2, adjusted mirrors before each outing, you name it. It was infuriating. We'd be on the freeway, cars blowing by left and right. Some of them would blare their horns because, honestly, driving the speed limit makes you a road hazard. I wanted to get out and push. I felt that way all damn day today. 5 kilometers per hour is literally a walking pace, and I drove that speed for 8 hours. But the slow speed ensured that I wouldn't fall into any more powder pits along the way. And, of course, I didn't encounter any. I could have driven full speed and had no problems, but better safe than sorry. The good news is I'm off the ramp. I camped out as soon as the terrain flattened out. I've already overdone my driving time for the day. I could go further. I still have 15% battery power or so, but I want to get as much daylight on my solar cells as I can. I'm in the Schiaparelli Basin at last, far from the crater wall, too. I get a full day of sunlight every day from now on. I decided it was time for a very special occasion. I ate the meal pack labeled, Survived Something That Should Have Killed Me. Oh my God, I forgot how good real food tastes. With luck, I'll get to eat Arrival in a few sols.
Log entry. Sol 503.
I didn't get as much recharge as I usually would yesterday. Because of my extended driving time, I only got up to 70% before night fell. So today's driving was abbreviated. I got 63 kilometers before I had to camp out again, but I don't even mind, because I'm only 148 kilometers from the MAV. That means I'll get there the sol after tomorrow. Holy hell, I'm really going to make it.
Log entry. Sol 504.
Holy shit, this is awesome. Holy shit, holy shit. Okay, calm. Calm. I made 90 kilometers today. By my estimate, I'm 50 kilometers from the MAV. I should get there sometime tomorrow. I'm excited about that, but here's what I'm really stoked about. I caught a blip from the MAV. NASA has the MAV broadcasting the Ares 3 HAB homing signal. Why wouldn't they? It makes perfect sense. The MAV is a sleek, perfectly functional machine ready to do what it's told, and they have it pretending to be the Ares 3 HAB, so my rover will see the signal and tell me where it is. That is an exceptionally good idea. I won't have to wander around looking for the thing. I'm going straight to it. I only caught a blip. I'll get more as I get closer. It's strange to think that a sand dune will stop me from hearing what the MAV has to say when it can talk to Earth, no problem. The MAV has 3 redundant methods of communicating with Earth, but they're all extremely directed and are designed for line-of-sight communication, and there aren't any sand dunes between it and Earth when they talk. Somehow they messed with things to make a radial signal, however weak it may be, and I heard it. My message for the day was, got beacon signal. If I'd had enough rocks, I would have added awesome idea, but it's a really sandy area. The MAV waited in southwestern Schiaparelli. It stood an impressive 27 meters tall
its conical body gleaming in the midday sun. The rover crested a nearby dune with the trailer in tow. It slowed for a few moments, then continued toward the ship at top speed. It came to a stop 20 meters away. There it remained for 10 minutes while the astronaut inside suited up. He stumbled excitedly out of the airlock, falling to the ground, then scrambling to his feet. Beholding the MAV, he gestured to it with both arms as if in disbelief. He leaped into the air several times, arms held high with fists clenched. Then he knelt on one knee and fist-pumped repeatedly. Running to the spacecraft, he hugged landing strut B. After a few moments, he broke off the embrace to perform another round of leaping celebrations. Now fatigued, the astronaut stood with arms akimbo, looking up at the sleek lines of the engineering marvel before him. Climbing the ladder on the landing stage, he reached the ascent stage and entered the airlock. He sealed the door behind him. Chapter 25. Log Entry. Sol 505.
I finally made it. I'm at the MAV. Well, right this second, I'm back in the rover. I did go into the MAV to do a systems check and boot up. I had to keep my EVA suit on the whole time because there's no life support in there just yet. It's going through a self-check right now, and I'm feeding it oxygen and nitrogen with hoses from the rover. This is all part of the MAV's design. It doesn't bring air along. Why would it? That's a needless wait when you'll have a hab full of air right next door. I'm guessing folks at NASA are popping champagne right now and sending me lots of messages. I'll read them in a bit. First things first, get the MAV some life support. Then I'll be able to work inside comfortably. And then I'll have a boring conversation with NASA. Well, the content may be interesting, but the 14-minute transmission time between here and Earth will be a bit dull. 1300 hours, 7 minutes. Houston. Congratulations from all of us here at Mission Control. Well done. What's your status? 1300 hours, 21 minutes. MAV. Thanks. No health or physical problems. The rover and trailer are getting pretty worn out, but still functional. Oxygenator and regulator both working fine. I didn't bring the water reclaimer. Just brought the water. Plenty of potatoes left. I'm good to last till 5:49. 1300 hours, 36 minutes. Houston. Glad to hear it. Hermes is still on track for a Sol 5:49 flyby. As you know, the MAV will need to lose some weight to make the intercept. We're going to get you those procedures within the day. How much water do you have? What did you do with urine? 1300 hours, 50 minutes. MAV. I have 550 liters of remaining water. I've been dumping urine outside along the way. 1400 hours, 5 minutes. Houston. Preserve all water. Don't do any more urine dumps. Store it somewhere. Turn the rover's radio on and leave it on. We can contact it through the MAV. Bruce trudged into Venkat's office and unceremoniously plopped down in a chair. He dropped his briefcase and let his arms hang limp.
Have a good flight? Venkat asked.
I only have a passing memory of what sleep is, Bruce said.
So is it ready? Venkat asked.
Yes, it's ready. But you're not going to like it.
Go on.
Bruce steeled himself and stood, picking up his briefcase. He pulled a booklet from it.
Bear in mind, this is the end result of thousands of hours of work, testing, and lateral thinking by all the best guys at JPL.
I'm sure it was hard to trim down a ship that's already designed to be as light as possible, Venkat said.
Bruce slid the booklet across the desk to Venkat.
The problem is the intercept velocity. The MAV is designed to get to low Mars orbit, which only requires 4.1 kilometers per second, but the Hermes flyby will be at 5.8 kilometers per second.
Venkat flipped through the pages.
Care to summarize?
First, we're going to add fuel. The MAV makes its own fuel from the Martian atmosphere, but it's limited by how much hydrogen it has.
it brought enough to make 19,397 kilograms of fuel, as it was designed to do. If we can give it more hydrogen, it can make more.
How much more?
For every kilogram of hydrogen, it can make 13 kilograms of fuel. Watney has 550 liters of water. We'll have him electrolyze it to get 60 kilograms of hydrogen.
Bruce reached over the desk and flipped a few pages, pointing to a diagram.
The fuel plant can make 780 kilograms of fuel from that.
If he electrolyzes his water, what'll he drink?
He only needs 50 liters for the time he has left, and the human body only borrows water. We'll have him electrolyze his urine, too. We need all the hydrogen we can get our hands on.
I see. And what does 780 kilograms of fuel buy us? Venkat asked.
It buys us 300 kilograms of payload. It's all about fuel versus payload. The MAV's launch weight is over 12,600 kilograms. Even with the bonus fuel, we'll need to get that down to 7,300 kilograms. So the rest of this booklet is how to remove over 5,000 kilograms from the ship.
Venkat leaned back. Walk me through it.
Bruce pulled another copy of the booklet from his briefcase.
There were some gimmies right off the bat. The design presumes 500 kilograms of Martian soil and rock samples. Obviously, we won't do that. Also, there's just one passenger instead of six. That saves 500 kilograms when you consider their weight plus their suits and gear. And we can lose the other five acceleration chairs. And of course, we'll remove all non-essential gear. The med kit, tool kit, internal harnessing, straps, and anything else that isn't nailed down. And some stuff that is. Next up, he continued, we're ditching all life support. The tanks, pumps, heaters, airlines, CO2, absorption system, even the insulation on the inner side of the hull. We don't need it. We'll have Watney wear his EVA suit for the whole trip.
Won't that make it awkward for him to use the controls? Venkat asked.
He won't be using them, Bruce said. Major Martinez will pilot the MAV remotely from Hermes. It's already designed for remote piloting. It was remotely landed, after all.
But if something goes wrong, Venkat asked.
Martinez is the best trained pilot, Bruce said. If there is an emergency, he's the guy you want controlling the ship.
Venkat said cautiously. We've never had a manned ship controlled remotely before, but... Okay, go on.
Since Watney won't be flying the ship, Bruce continued, he won't need the controls. We'll ditch the control panels and all the power and data lines that lead to them.
Wow, Venkat said. We're really gutting this thing.
I'm just getting started, Bruce said. The power needs will be dramatically reduced now that life support is gone, so we'll dump three of the five batteries and the auxiliary power system. The orbital maneuvering system has three redundant thrusters. We'll get rid of those. Also, the secondary and tertiary comm systems can go.
Wait, what? Venkat said, shocked. You're going to have a remote-controlled ascent with no backup comm systems?
No point, Bruce said. If the comm system goes out during ascent, the time it takes to reacquire will be too long to do any good. The backups don't help us.
This is getting really risky, Bruce.
Bruce sighed. I know. There's just no other way. And I'm not even to the nasty stuff yet.
Venkat rubbed his forehead. By all means, tell me the nasty stuff.
We'll remove the nose airlock, the windows, and hull panel 19.
Venkat blinked. You're taking the front of the ship off?
Sure, Bruce said. The nose airlock alone is 400 kilograms. The windows are pretty damn heavy, too, and they're connected by hull panel 19, so may as well take that, too.
So he's going to launch with a big hole in front of the ship.
We'll have him cover it with hab canvas.
Hab canvas? For a launch to orbit?
Bruce shrugged. The hull's mostly there to keep the air in. Mars's atmosphere is so thin you don't need a lot of streamlining. By the time the ship's going fast enough for air resistance to matter, it'll be high enough that there's practically no air.
We've run all the simulations. Should be good.
You're sending him to space under a tarp?
Pretty much, yeah.
Like a hastily loaded pickup truck.
Yeah. Can I go on?
Sure. Can't wait.
We'll also have him remove the back panel of the pressure vessel. It's the only other panel he can remove with the tools on hand. Also, we're getting rid of the auxiliary fuel pump. Sad to see it go, but it weighs too much for its usefulness. And we're nixing a Stage 1 engine.
An engine?
Yeah, the Stage 1 booster works fine if one engine goes out. It'll save us a huge amount of weight. Only during the Stage 1 ascent, but still. Pretty good fuel savings.
Bruce fell silent.
That it? Venkat asked.
Yeah.
Venkat sighed. You've removed most of the safety backups. What's this do to the estimated odds of failure?
It's about 4%.
Jesus Christ, Venkat said. Normally we'd never even consider something that risky.
It's all we've got, Venk, Bruce said. We've tested it all out and run simulations galore. We should be okay if everything works the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, great, Venkat said.
0800 hours, 41 minutes. MAV.
You fucking kidding me?
0800 hours, 55 minutes. Houston. Admittedly, they are very invasive modifications, but they have to be done. The procedure doc we sent has instructions for carrying out each of these steps with tools you have on hand. Also, you'll need to start electrolyzing water to get the hydrogen for the fuel plant. We'll send you procedures for that shortly. 0900 hours, 9 minutes. MAV. You're sending me into space in a convertible. 0900 hours, 24 minutes. Houston. There will be hab canvas covering the holes. It will provide enough aerodynamics in Mars's atmosphere. 0900 hours, 38 minutes. MAV. So it's a ragtop. Much better. Log entry. Sol 506. On the way here, in my copious free time, I designed a workshop. I figured I'd need space to work on stuff without having to wear an EVA suit. I devised a brilliant plan whereby the current bedroom would become the new home of the regulator and the oxygenator, and the now empty trailer would become my workshop. It's a stupid idea, and I'm not doing it. All I need is a pressurized area that I can work in. I somehow convinced myself that the bedroom wasn't an option because it's a hassle to get stuff into it, but it won't be that bad. It attaches to the rover airlock, so the getting stuff in is going to be annoying. Bring the stuff into the rover, attach the bedroom to the airlock from the inside, inflate it, bring the stuff into the bedroom. I'll also have to empty the bedroom of all tools and equipment to fold it up any time I need to do an EVA. So yeah, it'll be annoying, but all it costs me is time. And I'm actually doing well on that front. I have 43 more sols before Hermes flies by. And looking at the procedure NASA has in mind for the modifications, I can take advantage of the MAV itself as a workspace. The lunatics at NASA have me doing all kinds of rape to the MAV, but I don't have to open the hull till the end. So the first thing I'll do is clear out a bunch of clutter, like chairs and control panels and the like. Once they're out, I'll have a lot of room in there to work. But I didn't do anything to the soon-to-be-mutilated MAV today. Today was all about system checks. Now that I'm back in contact with NASA, I have to go back to being all safety first. Strangely, NASA doesn't have total faith in my clutched-together rover or my method of piling everything into the trailer. They had me do a full systems check on every single component. Everything's still working fine, though it's wearing down. The regulator and the oxygenator are at less than peak efficiency, to say the least, and the trailer leaks some air every day. Not enough to cause problems, but it's not a perfect seal. NASA's pretty uncomfortable with it, but we don't have any other options. Then they had me run a full diagnostic on the MAV. That's in much better shape. Everything's sleek and pristine and perfectly functional. I'd almost forgotten what new hardware even looks like. Pity I'm going to tear it apart.
You killed Watney, Lewis said.
Yeah, Martinez said, scowling at his monitor. The words, collision with terrain, blinked accusingly.
I pulled a nasty trick on him, Johansson said. I gave him a malfunctioning altitude readout and made Engine 3 cut out too early. It's a deadly combination.
Shouldn't have been a mission failure, Martinez said. I should have noticed the readout was wrong. It was way off.
Don't sweat it, Lewis said. That's why we drill.
Aye, Commander, Martinez said.
He furrowed his brow and frowned at the screen. Lewis waited for him to snap out of it. When he didn't, she put a hand on his shoulder.
Don't beat yourself up, she said. They only gave you 2 days of remote launch training. It was only supposed to happen if we aborted before landing, a cut-our-losses scenario where we'd launch the MAV to act as a satellite. It wasn't mission-critical, so they didn't drill you too hard on it. Now that Mark's life depends on it, you've got 3 weeks to get it right, and I have no doubt you can do it.
Aye, Commander, Martinez said, softening his scowl. Resetting the sim, Johansson said. Anything specific you want to try?
Surprise me, Martinez said.
Lewis left the control room and made her way to the reactor. As she climbed up the ladder to the center of the ship, the centripetal force on her diminished to zero. Vogel looked up from a computer console.
Commander!
How are the engines? She asked, grabbing a wall-mounted handle to stay attached to the slowly turning room.
All working within tolerance, Vogel said. I am now doing a diagnostic on the reactor. I am thinking that Johansson is busy with the launching training, so perhaps I do this diagnostic for her.
Good idea, Lewis said. And how's our course?
All is well, Vogel said. No adjustments necessary. We are still on track to plan trajectory within 4 meters.
Keep me posted if anything changes.
Yeah, Commander.
Floating to the other side of the core, Lewis took the other ladder out, again gaining gravity as she went down. She made her way to the airlock 2 ready room. Beck held a coil of metal wire in one hand and a pair of work gloves in the other.
Hey, Commander, what's up?
I'd like to know your plan for recovering Mark.
Easy enough if the intercept is good, Beck said. I just finished attaching all the tethers we have into one long line. It's 214 meters long. I'll have the MMU pack on, so moving around will be easy. I can get going up to around 10 meters per second safely. Any more and I risk breaking the tether if I can't stop in time.
Once you get to Mark, how fast a relative velocity can you handle?
I can grab the MAV easily at 5 meters per second. 10 meters per second is kind of like jumping onto a moving train. Anything more than that and I might miss.
So including the MMU safe speed, we need to get the ship within 20 meters per second of his velocity.
And the intercept has to be within 214 meters, Beck said. Pretty narrow margin of error.
We've got a lot of leeway, Lewis said. The launch will be 52 minutes before the intercept, and it takes 12 minutes. As soon as Mark's S2 engine cuts out, we'll know our intercept point and velocity. If we don't like it, we'll have 40 minutes to correct. Our engine's 2 millimeters per second may not seem like much, but in 40 minutes, it can move us up to 5.7 kilometers.
Good, Beck said. And 214 meters isn't a hard limit, per se.
Yes, it is, Lewis said.
Nah, Beck said. I know I'm not supposed to go untethered, but without my leash I could get way out there.
Not an option, Lewis said.
But we could double or even triple our safe intercept range.
We're done talking about this, Lewis said sharply.
Aye, Commander.
Log entry. Sol 526. There aren't many people who can say they vandalized a $3 billion spacecraft, but I'm one of them. I've been pulling critical hardware out of the MAV left and right. It's nice to know that my launch to orbit won't have any pesky backup systems weighing me down. First thing I did was remove the small stuff. Then came the things I could disassemble, like the crew seats, several of the backup systems, and the control panels. I'm not improvising anything. I'm following a script sent by NASA which was set up to make things as easy as possible. Sometimes I miss the days when I made all the decisions myself. Then I shake it off and remember I'm infinitely better off with a bunch of geniuses deciding what I do than I am making shit up as I go along.
Periodically, I suit up, crawl into the airlock with as much junk as I can fit, and dump it outside. The area around the MAV looks like the set of Sanford and Son. I learned about Sanford and Son from Lewis's collection. Seriously, that woman needs to see someone about her 70s problem. Log entry. Sol 529. I'm turning water into rocket fuel. It's easier than you'd think. Separating hydrogen and oxygen only requires a couple of electrodes and some current. The problem is collecting the hydrogen. I don't have any equipment for pulling hydrogen out of the air. The atmospheric regulator doesn't even know how. The last time I had to get hydrogen out of the air, back when I turned the HAB into a bomb, I burned it to turn it into water. Obviously, that would be counterproductive. But NASA thought everything through and gave me a process. First, I disconnected the rover and trailer from each other. Then, while wearing my EVA suit, I depressurized the trailer and backfilled it with pure oxygen at 1/4 of an atmosphere. Then I opened a plastic box full of water and put a couple of electrodes in. That's why I needed the atmosphere. Without it, the water would just boil immediately and I'd be hanging around in a steamy atmosphere. The electrolysis separated the hydrogen and oxygen from each other. Now the trailer was full of even more oxygen and also hydrogen. Pretty dangerous, actually. Then I fired up the atmospheric regulator. I know I just said it doesn't recognize hydrogen, but it does know how to yank oxygen out of the air. I broke all the safeties and set it to pull 100% of the oxygen out. After it was done, all that was left in the trailer was hydrogen. That's why I started out with an atmosphere of pure oxygen, so the regulator could separate it later. Then I cycled the rover's airlock with the inner door open. The airlock thought it was evacuating itself, but it was actually evacuating the whole trailer. The air was stored in the airlock's holding tank. And there you have it, a tank of pure hydrogen. I carried the airlock's holding tank to the MAV and transferred the contents to the MAV's hydrogen tanks. I've said this many times before, but hooray for standardized valve systems. Finally, I fired up the fuel plant, and it got to work making the additional fuel I'd need. I'll need to go through this process several more times as the launch date approaches. I'm even going to electrolyze my urine. That'll make for a pleasant smell in the trailer. If I survive this, I'll tell people I was pissing rocket fuel. 1900 hours, 22 minutes. Johansson. Hello, Mark. 1900 hours, 23 minutes. MAV. Johansson? Holy crap! They finally letting you talk to me directly? 1900 hours, 24 minutes. Johansson. Yes, NASA gave the okay for direct communication an hour ago. We're only 35 light seconds apart, so we can talk in near real time. I just set up the system and I'm testing it out. 1900 hours, 24 minutes. MAV. What took them so long to let us talk? 1900 hours, 25 minutes. Johansson. The psych team was worried about personality conflicts. 1900 hours, 25 minutes. MAV. What, just 'cause you guys abandoned me on a godforsaken planet with no chance of survival? 1900 hours, 26 minutes. Johansson. Funny. Don't make that kind of joke with Lewis. 1900 hours, 27 minutes. MAV. Roger. So, thanks for coming back to get me. 1900 hours, 27 minutes. Johansson. It's the least we could do. How is the MAV retrofit going? 1900 hours, 28 minutes. MAV. So far, so good. NASA put a lot of thought into the procedures. They work. That's not to say they're easy. I spent the last 3 days removing hull panel 19 and the front window. Even in Mars G, they're heavy motherfuckers. 1900 hours, 29 minutes. Johansson. When we pick you up, I will make wild, passionate love to you. Prepare your body. 1900 hours, 29 minutes. Johansson. I didn't type that. That was Martinez. I stepped away from the console for like 10 seconds. 1900 hours, 29 minutes. MAV. I've really missed you guys. Log entry.
Sol 543.
I'm done? I think I'm done. I did everything on the list. The MAV is ready to fly. And in 6 sols, that's just what it'll do. I hope. It might not launch at all. I did remove an engine, after all. I could have fucked up all sorts of things during that process, and there's no